I'm turning now to the book of Judges, chapter 8 and verse 4. The book of Judges, chapter 8, verse 4. And Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint, that is, exhausted, yet pursuing them. So they pursue the remaining 15,000, we're told later, of Midianites, so many having slain one another after the event of the earlier verses which we've studied previously. So we come to this fourth verse, and these things we remind ourselves are written for our learning. My general title for this evening is Resisting the Flesh. And my first heading will be dictated by the passage, and it is the flesh, that is fallen human nature. The flesh is faithless, and we see an illustration of it right here. So Gideon comes to the men of Succoth, that's in Gadite territory, and he appeals to them for help to feed his exhausted 300. He has only 300. No great army. You know what happened to the many who were set aside by the Lord, leaving only 300. So it isn't a large request to feed 300 from a city the size of Succoth. And yet the response he gets is awful from Israelites. Verse 5, he said unto the men of Succoth, give me, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint. It's not a strong enough word for the original, really, which in our day, which indicates that they were exhausted. And I am pursuing after Zebah and Zalmunna, the principal Midianite rulers and kings. And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna now in thine hand? Do you think you've conquered them? You haven't had the victory yet. You haven't won yet. Do you think we should give bread to your army in these insecure circumstances? They could turn on you and defeat you. There were 15,000 of them there. That was a remnant. And you were just a handful. And there could be a rout, and then we'll have to answer to them for feeding you. So out of cowardice and complete absence of any patriotism, any concern for the cause of God and the defeat of the Midianites, unmoved by the fact that the Midianite vast host, all the 120,000 of them had already fallen, by the miraculous intervention of God, turning them one against another, and clearly the hand of God was with them. No sense of that at all. These people are so hard and unspiritual, and they deny any help or assistance to Gideon because they fear reprisals. Are these kings now in your hand? You shouldn't be so hasty. They've got no faith. We don't believe you. We don't believe that there can be a conquest under these circumstances, even though 90% of it had already been accomplished. And Gideon gives them a warning. Verse 7 is often not read as a warning, but just a threat. But we should read it as a warning. Gideon said, therefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zebah and Zalmunna into mine hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. The princes, the leaders, the opinion formers of that city would be punished, and in a dreadfully symbolic way. It's a warning. Are they going to shiver and think? And perhaps relent and repent. They're warned by Gideon, but no, they're hard and obdurate. They do not believe him. they reject him. So the warning is fruitless, and the warning becomes a threat. It is a prophecy indeed. But the same thing was repeated at Penuel, also in Gadite territory. And he went up thence to Penuel, verse 8, and spake unto them likewise, and they answered him just in as the men, the leaders of Succoth, had answered him. And then he warns them in verse 10, another warning. It's an opportunity to relent and repent. When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. First time we've heard of that, but they had a tower there, and they would take refuge in it, high and strong. But it made them proud and faithless, and it would be dismantled, torn down. No doubt they smirked and scorned and derided Gideon and his message. Well, the narrative hurries on in verse 10. Now Zebah and Zalmunna were in Karkah, and their hosts with them, the 15,000 residual men, all that were left. And Gideon went up, it records in verse 11, I want to hurry tonight, and smote the host. The host was secure, end of verse 11. They were camped down in a heavily protected manner, but it wasn't good enough to withstand Gideon, still working in the power of the Lord. And when Zebah and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them. Their names are repeatedly mentioned, and he took them and discomfited all the host, so that few were left or willing after that to carry out any fighting. And Gideon, verse 13, it was all accomplished by these 300 exhausted men in a very short space of time, and he returned from battle before the sun was up. And you see his approach to justice. Verse 14, he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and inquired of him. He wanted the names, and we would say the addresses, of the princes of Succoth. None would be left out of his reprisal, of his judgment. And there were 77 of them. And he came unto the men of Succoth and said, behold, he'd spared the lives of Zebah and Zalmunna just to, no doubt, bound, thrust them into the presence of those elders and princes of Succoth. Here are the men concerning your scornful deriding of me and my 300, he effectively says. And in verse 16, he took the elders of the city, appears to have spared the main residents, and punished them in some manner. Some people think they were dragged across a bed of thorns and briars, and by whatever means, he taught the men of Succoth. In other words, they had a severe warning about their faithlessness and their refusal to help. But it's quite a narrative. Why is there this so much time and space given by the Word of God to this event? It's been described as almost an incidental narrative. Some people have even questioned it. We should never do that. But why is it given at such length? Because it's for us. It illustrates the ugliness and the horror of, these were Israelites, let's say, translating the events of the typical church into the true church of Christ, the horror of people who have no sympathy or faith or zeal to support the work of God. And you hear of this, you hear of pastors. I was hearing this just recently at School of Theology. One or two men been called to certain churches, and they say it's very, very difficult to get anyone to do anything. In this church, they're nice people, and they love the Lord, but as for getting anything going and increasing the Sunday school and getting the visitation going or anything like that, constant calls for help fall on deaf ears. Well, they may be saved, and they may be nice people, but what a tragedy What a shame that there isn't any heart and there isn't any zeal. And sometimes pastors have to labour long and patiently to get just barely a flicker out of people. I'm not complaining here. There's so many very willing servants of the Lord. But you hear of this constantly. And I'm sure we have some people in this category who just do not have the heart for the Lord or for souls or loyalty or indebtedness to him to lift a finger. How tragic. But the severity of the way in which those Israelites in the typical church were dealt with here at least conveys to us that this is serious and that God is displeased with his people if there isn't a flicker of zeal and feeling and desire and participation. And you may not be dragged across a bed of briars, but dear friends, there may be something you're deprived of by the Lord, not by us on earth, some blessing, some advance, some assurance, some help because of indifference. So we're warned by these passages that in the view of God it is very serious not to be indebted to him, not to be his servant, not to do what we can while we can and make our contribution. It's the flesh that was faithless. They didn't believe that even the remnant of the Midianites could be subdued and overcome. They didn't believe, even though they'd been given a miracle to help them with the vast majority of the Midianite army just vanquished. They still didn't believe. That's the flesh. If we constantly give way to fallen human nature, if we're saved, we have a new nature, but the old nature is still there. It's still there trying to assert itself. And if we allow it to do so, I'm going to skip devotions, skip meetings, opt out of this, back out of that, take the easy course, and so on, then eventually we lose faith. We can't believe the promises of God. And we drift. And it's this kind of lesson that we see. And we apply it to ourselves. And we're warned, even though we're living in a different order of things, a different dispensation, if you like. There's an interesting passage here after this judgment, where in verse 21, or verse 20, "And he," that is Gideon, "said unto Jether his firstborn, Up and slay them. But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared, because he was yet a youth." Now there is much discussion about this verse. Why is it recorded? Why are we told this? If we're not careful, it almost looks as though Gideon is unreasonable. We might conjure up in our mind a picture of a boy who's maybe 12 or 13 or 14. Of course, he won't feel he's up to the occasion, suddenly being asked to slay these two gigantic figures of the Midianite oppression. Would Gideon have done such a thing? What would be the point of that? What would be the point of recording it? Well, there are all manner of suggestions, and I think among the best is something like this, but it is speculation. On the other hand, there has to be a reason. It's something like this. Jether was quite an assertive young man. Maybe he was 17, 18. Maybe he was just a bit too assertive, a bit sure himself. Gideon was not a king. They tried to make him a king and he declined. But he was a judge and a mighty military leader under God. And that perhaps puffed the lad up a little bit. Maybe there's a little bit of psychology going on here from Gideon. You slay him. And all of a sudden the boy discovers his inadequacies. And fear takes hold of him. And he cannot do this ghastly thing. It's an attractive explanation, a very humbling exercise. But we all need something like that sometimes. We get too confident. Without being 17, we could be 37 or 57. We get too confident, too sure we can do this and we can do that. And the Lord has a way of humbling us. So Jephthah had the sword, and the two men, they were no threat, they were bound. They couldn't strike back, but he couldn't do it. And he learned. He was still a youngster, and there were times when he should hold his tongue and think more carefully. Maybe something like that is going on. Then Zebah and Zalmunna said to Gideon, that is, rise thou and fall upon us. Why are they so anxious to have the adults execute them? Because death will come quickly. Not through badly aimed blows and half-done measures. Then they'll perish without so much agony. That's what's no doubt behind it. But then I come down to verse 22 and another heading, and it's this. Flesh trusts in human rule. We have to remember that the old nature is within us. The tendency to trust human strength, human rule. And so the men of Israel said unto Gideon, rule thou over us. And you can start a whole line of kings. There'll be a famous dynasty. You rule over us. You and after you your son, and after you your son's son, and so on. Because you're proven. You have delivered us from the hand of Midian. Well, they're wrong, of course. Gideon hadn't done it. God had done it. Gideon was probably very fearful about the whole thing. Cutting his army down to 300 and all the rest of it. As nervous as anyone, but put his faith in the Lord and qualified for the hall of fame in Hebrews of men who exercised great faith. But nevertheless, it was God that did it, not him. But no, the people see only their hero, only a man. Even in the churches, people will look to a man. They'll look to a preacher. Instead of praying for him as a feeble instrument of God and praying for God to move hearts, they trust in their preachers or their people. And in these days of internet, famous celebrity preachers like famous film stars, the tendency even among born-again people to trust the flesh and things that the flesh can do. Well, you have it here. Be our king. The great call for a king. We can trust a king. We had a man like you, Gideon. Then we would feel secure. A man who could get rid of this Arab incursion, the Ishmaelites, the Midianites. Well, then we're secure. We don't want to be left trusting in the Lord. Trusting in him. We're not told to seek a king. We've never had that direction. We've been given a theocracy. This is before the monarchy, which was given to them, if you like, in reluctance by God, because of their cries and their weakness and their sin. However, here it is. They have the theocracy. It's a wonderful way of conducting the nation's affairs. But they want security, a great leader, ruler they can trust. Gideon gets it absolutely right in verse 23. I will not rule over you. Neither shall my son rule over you. A great temptation that for Gideon. Enormous temptation for anyone. To be asked to be king, absolute ruler. No trouble, no difficulty, no rebellion. All the tribes will agree, evidently. You'll be king. And we'll accommodate you in a splendid place. And all the trappings of kingship. And the flesh would say, yes. But Gideon, up to this point, says no. It's not the will of God. The Lord shall rule over you. But then, verse 24, things take a downward turn. Gideon makes an enormous mistake, a tremendous mistake. It's now that things start to go a little wrong. And Gideon said unto them, I would desire a request of you, that you would give me every man the earrings, or the nose rings possibly, but our translators, and they're probably right, prefer the earrings, but it's in the singular, as many point out, and it could be a nose ring. Anyway, that's irrelevant. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites, Midianites, Arabs, Ishmaelites. And they answered, we will willingly give them. And they spread a garment, and the weight is given in verse 26. I do not know the modern equivalent of the weight. I've seen from 30 pounds to 100 pounds weight by experts who say they know just how to calculate it. So it's somewhere between those figures, tremendous amount, the weight of the golden earrings, and then other items and ornaments too. And Gideon, verse 27, made an ephod thereof. Now an ephod was the high priest's vest, so-called, of different priceless materials, bejeweled, and which supported the breastplate, the heavily jeweled high priest's breastplate. And the high priest had to wear that when he sought the guidance of God in the holy place, which was in Shiloh, which was in Ephraimite territory. And we suppose that Gideon wasn't terribly welcome in that territory. Though they'd asked him to be ruler, his action had offended the Ephraimites. He'd calmed them down, but maybe he wasn't welcome. Or he didn't wish to be travelling there, and this was his temptation. He thought he'd have a place to seek the guidance and the leading of God in Ophrah, his own city, the capital city of his own tribal region. And so he had this ephod, which clearly means ephod and breastplate, and it's shorthanded to just ephod. You wouldn't have just the vest. You've got the whole thing, the trappings, the bejeweled, and then you can... And I wonder if he appointed his own priest too. How extensive was this irregularity? He made something he shouldn't have made. There was only one ephod and breastplate, and that was supposed to be made in the proper way by the directions of Moses and kept only by the high priest in the holy place at that time at Shiloh. So now he's duplicated the ephod and the breastplate. What else did he duplicate? The old writers think he duplicated a priest to go with it, and appointed a priest. Doesn't say so, but it might very well follow that he did that. And he already had an altar which God had authorized, but not a duplicate altar to the one at Shiloh. His altar was only a monument, a memorial. Perhaps he turned it into one that could be used for worship. Who knows? One thing led to another. He's not introducing idolatry. There's no teraphim. There's no idol. There's nothing of Baal here. He's pure in his worship, but he's very, very foolish to have departed from the clear commands of God and duplicated a priceless item for himself. And it became a snare. And the people went there to worship and worshipped it. And in their view, it was an idol, an object of worship. It's there in verse 27. All Israel, which divided the country, you can imagine some people going to Shiloh and some people coming to Ophrah. All Israel went thither, a whoring, committing adultery, literally, spiritual adultery, of course. After it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. It was already a snare to the people, but it was a snare to him too. In what way was it a snare? A trap, a noose. And a trap gets you, gets the animal, say, by the leg. And its grip is tightened as the animal struggles. And the animal then loses all its energy and tears its leg and bleeds and dies. It's a kind of progressive thing. The hunter doesn't find it soon. Terrible suffering. Started off just taking a foot. But soon the animal was in its grip and at its mercy and dying. This word snare is used advisedly. That foolish concession by a man who hadn't actually deserted the Lord and had been famous for his great act of faith and loyalty to the Lord made a compromise. And that compromise ruined his walk with God and brought him down like a snare further and further. And you read on that he had many wives. Numerous wives. 70 sons would take a number of wives. And we don't know how many daughters, they're not mentioned. Snares, one thing led to another. If you can bend the Lord's rule in a small thing, you can bend the Lord's rules in a bigger thing, then a bigger thing, then a bigger thing. And the man who refused to be king is now lording it as he wishes. The Lord was very kind to him. He was never disciplined in his lifetime, personally, in a severe manner, by terrible sickness or death. He lived a long life, and his faithful accomplishment benefited the nation for 40 years in his own lifetime, let alone for a time afterwards. But the problems were visited upon his house, and the difficulties, they did descend, and terrible things resulted. And Gideon is a warning to every one of us. Gideon got so far, successfully, and in faith, and then began to fail, little by little. Didn't do anything terrible, just a little departure from the rules, which became worse and worse. So with us, we all have to be warned. Yes, you could be an aging pastor, but you have to be as careful as when you were a youngster. And so do you. And if you have great success spiritually, and the Lord blesses you, and all your dear children come through for the Lord, and your Sunday school classes are blessed, and everything you do, the devil can still bring you down. Small sins, bigger sins. We have to be warned. These things are for our learning. It's solemn. But they help us. They safeguard us. Even someone who was in the Hebrews Hall of Fame went off track. Not necessarily in his personal faith, but in his obedience to God, with consequences. Well, here it is. In the record, we look down chapter 8 and verse 28. Thus was Midian subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted up their heads in defiance and in aggression no more. And the country was in quietness 40 years in the days of Gideon. And Jerubbaal, another name for Gideon, as you know, why is it used? Why is the record now going to switch to calling him Jerubbaal? Can't be certain of this, but it seems to suggest that we're looking now at the dismal portion of his later life. The son of Joash went and dwelt in his own house. I should think in some splendor now. And he had 70 sons. many wives. And verse 31, he had a mistress in Shechem. She would have been a Canaanite. She also bare him a son, whose name he called Abimelech, which means the name he paraded round in was something like, "My father is a king." However, it might not quite mean that. It might refer to heavenly king. "My father is the heavenly king," which would be a lot better name than "My father is king," which would make the youngster very arrogant, one would think. But not sure about that, what is intended. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried and so on. As soon as he was dead, the people turned to idolatry. And Baal is their god. And they remembered not the Lord their God, neither showed they kindness, verse 35, to the house of Jerubbaal, namely Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel. Dare I get into chapter 9? It is so important to us. Yes, I think a little. The flesh harbours kings. I'll try and do it very quickly. The flesh harbours kings. In your old nature, buried inside you as a Christian, trying to assert itself, you either want or you would like to be a king. Human nature always wants either a king to worship or to be a king. Even in church, the old nature can come out. Perhaps some people are not truly converted. But rather interesting, I had two pastors talking to me at School of Theology about internet churches in their fellowships. I think I understand what they mean, because we had a touch of this a while ago. An internet church operating within the fellowship. And what they were upset about was there were people, some people, who younger people who were savvy and clued up, and they were using social media, and they had selected a band of people within their church who would be their private church, their online church, their own church. And of course, they were the pastor. Some, the king inside us. Oh, I can be the king. Actually, slightly more often you hear about this, it's not king, but queen. It's a lady who does it. I'm going to be queen, and I'm going to recruit and enroll some people and send them messages every day or every few days, and they'll respond. And they'll either like what I do or they're for it. And I will discipline them, make them feel terrible if they're not walking aright as members of my internet group, my band, my church within a church. Oddly enough, talking to these men, they had the same experience that I had once. The people who do this are not people you would ever appoint officially within the church to be guides, teachers, or mentors of others. They appointed themselves. They had very high opinion of themselves, and they have more kingship or queenship than any pastor. Pastors work with their elders and their deacons. They're one among a group. Pastors are helpers in your joy. They don't lord it over your faith and push you about and tell you what to do. But these unofficial pastors or kings or queens with their little internet circles, they're terribly bossy and authoritative. It's the king inside someone, the queen inside someone, has found a little stamping ground. You have to be careful about these things, dear friends. The Lord has ordered his people and organized them into sympathetic companies called churches, with proper rules and proper qualifications and appointments, and the church all agreeing to certain people to be their elders or whatever. Something properly conducted. But the king inside wants to be special. And I think of this, well, whether I'll get into chapter 9, very quickly, we can do a few verses, because it's so interesting and it tells us something about human nature. Chapter 9, verse 1, Abimelech's plotting. Verse 2, he says to the people of Shechem, where he hatches his plot to be king, "Speak, I pray you, in the ears of all the men of Shechem, whether it is better for you, either that all the sons of Jerubbaal, which are 70 persons, reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh." Yes, he was born to a Canaanite mother in Shechem. "I'm one of you. It makes us all great if you support me. Something for them, for the flesh." Were the sons, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, acting as kings? I don't suppose so for a moment. This is a lie. They weren't ruling it over the people like their father. They declined to do that. They were not. This is just a lie by which he promotes himself. "You're going to come under the heel of all Gideon's sons. Rather have me. I'm one of you. Same stock. Same place." And so his mother's brethren spake of him in the ears of the community, and the plot was hatched, and money was raised, a sort of token money. And in verse 5, he went unto his father's house at Ophrah and slew his brethren, the sons of Gideon, being 70 persons upon one stone. That's very suspicious. That sounds as though it was an offering to Baal. He murdered 70 of his brothers and made them a kind of sacrificial offering to Baal. He was perverting everything. But Jotham, the youngest son of Gideon, was left. He'd hidden himself. Well, then they made Abimelech king. Just pause there. Can you believe it? The people of Israel made him king. Would you make king someone who'd murdered his 70 of his brothers? Astonishing. That would be so well known. This is no secret murder. It was some kind of family feast when all the brothers were gathered together. And with his henchmen, his mercenaries, he killed them all. And yet, the population of the country made him king. Well, we hear some astonishing things. We were hearing not long ago of a great celebrity pastor who had a church in Seattle. And ultimately, the church, kind of huge, huge church, collapsed under him. And it would appear he was guilty of all sorts of terrible things. And what happens? He goes to another part of the USA and starts another church. And people support him. And people say he's a great chap. And they overlook all that. And the various comments on the internet, "What a terrible thing." And other people come online and say, "Who are you to judge? Nobody's perfect." Yes, but the things he was charged with and the mess and the reputation he leaves behind. Then there's another man, very well known in America, very powerful in his presentation, and he committed adultery. His church threw him out, and another church promptly appointed him to an important position. He committed adultery again. A third church appointed him to a good position. Then it was found he'd committed adultery again. And he lay quiet, for he's got a famous grandfather, a great evangelist, now died. And there he is going around the country, establishing himself once again. And certain so-called Christian people and churches giving him preaching engagements. You never know what you hear. It's absolutely the same as this. Murdered 70 brothers and they make him king. How bad do you have to be? That shows the flesh and great spiritual decline and the laws of God set aside. That's how bad things can get. But the flesh harbours kings. And then there's a wonderful fable in chapter 9. Jotham, you know the passage. He goes to a mountain, goes in outside the city of Succoth, and he finds some prominent place, presumably where people gather, a kind of Hyde Park corner of a place, I don't know, where people gathered, some celebration there, or gathering, or festival of some sort, and he's able to stand on a rock and give his parable. It's brilliant, his fable. A fable. People remember fables, and what he had to say would be carried back to the people of Succoth and would be all around the land in those days in no time. And here is the fable. Where did he get it from? Did he make it up? I think it came from his father Gideon. I think you're seeing here Gideon's philosophy. Maybe he taught the children this fable. And when the children were growing up and they said, "Dad, we understand they wanted you to be king. Why didn't you want to be king?" I think he told them this fable. It's marvellous to help their young minds to understand why he didn't want to be king. The trees went forth, it's verse 8, on a time, one day, we would say, to anoint a king over them. And they said unto the olive tree, "Reign thou over us." But the olive tree said unto them, "Should I leave my fatness, wherewith by me they honour God and man, and go to be promoted over the trees?" Perfect. Gideon had no command of the Lord to be king. But he also said, "I'm appointed a judge by the Lord. I can serve him and help the nation and help people. Why do I want to be elevated to an unnecessary office to swagger about and lose my instrumentality and my work?" You could say this to people in denominations who lead them and so on. If you were called of God to preach the gospel and minister to the people, why give up doing that? To run a denominational office so that you can be important and organize something which the Bible never sanctioned. But anyway, some people say, well, the olive tree represents Gideon himself. And the next plant that follows, and the one after that, the fig and the vine, the three trees that refuse to be king, kind of represent his sons too, until you come to Abimelech. Why should we surrender, serving the Lord as we can, in order to be promoted to something which is not fruitful? And then he warns them that finally in the fable, the trees ask a bramble, "Will you be king over us?" A bramble representing a useless, unproductive, sparse plant that nevertheless invades everywhere it goes and hurts with its sharp thorns. That's what you've got in Abimelech, he says to them in effect. You've got a bramble, and you'll suffer. And in such and so long a time, he'll be gone. And there'll be tears. And that's exactly how it is. The Lord so works that all trust is lost between the men who at first promoted Abimelech, the men of Succoth, and the king. And he goes to quell them because an upstart arises to usurp him. And he's victorious until some shrewd lady from the parapet at the top of a tower sees him down there and drops a stone on his head, and that's the end of him. And that's Israel's first king. Self-appointed, wrongly appointed, unworthy, and his reign is at an end. But all these things are for our learning, dear friends, and we learn that the flesh is faithless. The flesh loves flesh, so the old nature wants to be king or support a king. The flesh will give ground and suggest compromises to you, and it has to be resisted. And why? Why have a king? Why all the devices of today? All the rock worship? All the strobe lights and the nonsense? And the theatre? And the human devices and the gimmicks? And the celebrities in the church? Why? When we have the Lord. When we have the Lord and the power of the Spirit, who saves souls and hears and answers our prayers and blesses us far beyond we ever deserve. Why? Listen to the flesh. The flesh and show is always to be resisted. I'm over time. That's quite enough for us this evening. Let's sing together the hymn 446.